Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 9:03 a.m. That is Guangzhou time. Today is August 17th. This is the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes for August 16th. And when we look at what's going on here in markets, we've certainly had a lot of volatility this week. And the S&P 500 rebounded on Friday to confirm at least near-term support in the region of the trend mean. So that's important. It could have broken down and it hasn't. There is a lot of worry going on out there at the moment. Everyone seems to be pricing in the scope for a recession within the next 18 months. Whether that is at the beginning of 2020 or the end of 2020 or in 2021 is still open for debate. This week we saw the yield curve spread become inverted in the USA, although I will say that I didn't actually see it happen. When we look at the chart, then I can see that it got almost down to zero and is closing out the week at 7 basis points, but I can't see on a daily basis that it went below zero. When I even look at the intraday chart, there is a, even if you look back at say 6 days, I can't see the point at which it went below zero. But lots of headlines are telling us that the yield curve did go inverted, and the market believes that that has in fact occurred. What we definitely know is that the UK's yield curve was inverted, and that we're starting to see inversions of the yield curve becoming progressively more likely in places like Singapore and Taiwan, that the prospect of additional monetary and fiscal stimulus is becoming progressively more likely in places like Australia and New Zealand, and that is also factoring into the way people are thinking that this is not simply a US or a European phenomenon, but that we are on the cusp of some significant difficulties in terms of the economic impact of the trade war for a significant number of economies globally. And one thing I can definitely see from walking around in China is that consumers have pulled in their wings, that we haven't had to queue for a restaurant since we've been here, and that's rather odd. Generally speaking, Guangzhou is one of the places where, well, you could consider it the gastronomic capital of China, and people love to go out and eat. It's part of the culture. We haven't had to queue, and we're certainly not thinking about we don't hold back from going to popular restaurants. That's part of the reason we love coming here, is to sample different foods. And the fact that there has no queue, there hasn't been any queuing, is something that I haven't ever seen before, and we've been coming here for a decade. So that is something that I think is rather important here, that the Chinese economy is slowing down, that people are contracting in terms of their spending. That's been evident in the purchases of new vehicles for quite some time. That was rationalized by people saying, well, an increasing number of municipalities have adopted the same kind of rules that Beijing has in order to try and reduce the number of cars within the city, but the upshot is much the same. When people want to buy a car, they're going to buy it one way or the other. One of the things that was happening in the go-go times in Beijing was that people bought two cars, and then they had different number plates so that they could drive them every day of the week. And, well, people aren't doing that anymore, and they are buying fewer cars. So there is definitely some evidence of a slowdown here in China, and people are downgrading their spending habits. That's clear. That's also evident in the continuous commodity index. When we look at the downtrend that we have here, it's it's really quite clear. And it was at a new reaction low in here this week. So we definitely have evidence of a slowing global economy. This isn't someone's imagination. We're seeing plenty of evidence of it. It's certainly in the commodity complex, in the performance of various bonds right across the world, and the contraction in yields. This is really quite clear. But then we have the additional point that the signals that we're getting from the bond market are being perverted by the reign of extraordinary monetary policy, and negative yields set off a cascade of buying at the longer end of the curve. That's part of the reason why we're getting the inverted yield curves. It's simple that when you look at the convexity of bond prices, their sensitivity to interest rates, when you get negative interest rates, it turns the equation completely upside down. So that has contributed to this massive run-up in the quantity of bonds that have got negative yields. And it was going up at almost $1 trillion a day. It's closing out this week at $16.39 trillion. This is rather incredible. Now, we had a similar move like this when we saw the first bonds go negative back in 2014. And now we've had another big move. Well, this is obviously setting up this massive momentum move that we've seen in yields, that contraction in the Australian 10-year yield is really rather incredible. And we've seen a very similar condition in US 10-year treasuries. We've had this incredible move higher in terms of the yield, lower in terms of the yield, and this run-up in prices. Now we're in an area of potential support for the yield. 1.5% has been a bit of a Rubicon over the course of the last decade, and yields have not sustained moves below it, particularly in 2012 and 2016. Then when we look at the 30-year, there was a lot of commentary this week that it had traded below 2%. That was a new low for the long yield. And now it's really very oversold, very overextended on the yield, and very overbought in the price. So there is clear potential here for a bounce in terms of the yield. And when we think about why that might be the case, well, monetary policy is generally tends to be the most important factor most of the time. And we are seeing increasingly committed efforts by central banks globally to tackle the threat of a global slowdown. Europe is most particularly where there is a threat of a global slowdown, or where where recessions are likely to start first. Europe has negative deposit rates. In Denmark, for example, they've had 0% mortgages for the first time ever. Then we look at what's going on between the UK and the European Union, and the uncertainty that that has created. The UK's yield curve was inverted this week, and they've had already one quarter of negative growth. Well, another quarter of negative growth, and it's a recession. So there is the potential that the UK is going to be the first of the European countries to go into recession. But it's quite likely that Germany won't be very far behind. And even the Germans are now starting to talk about fiscal stimulus. They are rather constrained by their constitution, but in the event that they have a recession, they do have leeway to engage in fiscal stimulus. What is looking increasingly likely, if we look at what different central banks have done around the world to try and tackle this same problem that they've all encountered, Well, the Japanese have attempted to manage the yield curve. They have been buying at both the long end and the short end. And what that has done is ensured that the bond yields are negative, but they're not as negative as they are in Europe, and that is helping to support the yen. Well, the other thing, of course, that they tried to do was they tried to devalue the currency, and because they've been less aggressive on the monetary front, then the yen has been a bit stronger recently, but it is still significantly weaker than it was before the Abenomics suite of policies was introduced back in 2012. They've also been buying equities, and the Bank of Japan is now the biggest holder, the biggest individual holder of Japanese equity ETFs, and that is helping to support the stock market. But because all of these policies have been are they've been relatively modest in scale, then we haven't had the kind of run-up in animal spirits that we've had, for example, on Wall Street. Well, Europe ended its quantitative easing program in December. Then they announced an LTRO program, which was designed to really give assistance to the banking sector because of the low interest rate environment and their inability to make any money in this kind of environment. And that has contributed to the slowdown in growth in Europe. Europe is just as addicted to stimulus as everywhere else. What we did see in here on Friday was that the banking sector has at least paused in the region of its lows from 2012 and 2016, and that it has scope for a bounce in here because Germany is talking about a fiscal stimulus. What we are now seeing in the Swiss National Bank is that they have been among the most aggressive in buying the shares not only of their own country but international equities as well, and that is in fact listed on the stock market. So we can see how effective the that policy has been, but it also shows us just how much money they've been spending in order to both increase the size of the balance sheet and to buy equities. The size of their equity portfolio has been contracting of late. That is, I think, highlights some of the risks in terms of buying equities, that they do tend to be more volatile than bonds, and they can go down as well as up. And of course, that is the boilerplate on every brokerage's website, but central banks don't really care about that. When we now look at what is going on in terms of the USA, well, they started out with monetary stimulus, and they've had QE1, 2, and 3. Then they elected President Trump and started in with fiscal stimulus, but the Federal Reserve decided that that was the perfect time to start withdrawing or reducing the size of the balance sheet, and they took approximately $600 billion out of circulation. Then we're now at a point where they need to, well, let's back up a little. They took $600 billion out of circulation. That started to have an impact on growth. It happened at exactly the same time that the fiscal impetus from the stimulus started to wane. So now we're starting to get a slowdown in growth, and people started to get worried about a recession. So they did try fiscal stimulus, but they at least counteracted some of the effects of it with a monetary contraction. Well, now what it looks increasingly likely that they're going to do is to engage in both fiscal and monetary stimulus simultaneously. And That is a really rather important change because the fiscal stimulus has already been agreed. They have increased the size of the budget deficit that is tolerable at least for the Congress for to $1.2 trillion over the course of the next 18 months. And at the same time, the Federal Reserve is lowering interest rates, and they are potentially going to start engaging in quantitative easing again. It's looking increasingly likely that Europe is also going to start engaging in quantitative easing again. And that also holds out the prospect of other countries engaging in much the same type of activity. So we have had a phenomenal move in terms of the bond markets because investors are not only pricing in the scope for central banks to continue to buy them, but negative interest rates are changing the valuation structure of how bonds are valued. So then that also is contributing to this bubbly activity. But it's very clear that it's important to remember that this is a bubble in terms of the bond markets. That when you think about what is the primary characteristic of a bubble, what sets a bubble apart from a major bull market, well, it's in the acceptance of contradiction. And that acceptance of contradiction is one of the hallmarks of a mania. And right now, we can see that in the bond markets because people are willing to bet that nobody has to bear the risk of owning a bond that is going to mature at a value less than what they paid for it. And that is one of the reasons why the run-up that we're seeing in longer-dated bonds has been so pronounced. When we think about the massive increase that we've seen in the 100-year bond in Austria, well, this is one of the few double A plus rated bonds out there, and it has been one of the best performing assets globally over the course of the last 3 or 4 months. But it is now susceptible to some pause in consolidation because with the potential for fiscal stimulus in Europe, then that does hold out the prospect that some of the more bearish and or I guess the view that Europe is completely without possibilities of savior is beginning to be tested if Germany is willing to engage in fiscal stimulus. Because if Germany is willing to engage in fiscal stimulus, then that holds out the prospect that the austerity program, which has been one of the greatest challenges for Europe over the course of the last decade, may be coming to an end or may at least be getting some relaxation. And that's really quite important for the region's equities. The equities certainly need some form of assistance, and they did bounce in here this week from the region of the trend mean. This was exactly where they needed to bounce. So that's an encouraging sign. I think one of the most important points is we are in August and a lot of people are on vacation, and this is a time when you do get more volatile trading and you do tend to get pullbacks in August or September or October, which sets up the fourth quarter as being the best performing quarter of the year. The fact that the vast majority of indices are finding support in the region of their respective trend means is also supportive of the view that investors are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside because monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. But the drive towards additional monetary and fiscal stimulus, the increasing cooperation between the monetary and fiscal authorities, the very real prospect that this is going to lead to a formalization of modern monetary theory. We really have it in practice already. It's really only a question of how long is it going to take before the practice is formulated or formalized. Well, what that is obviously putting pressure on is the currencies, and because there is the scope for lots of different countries to engage in it, then it's gold that is rallying. It's not so much that gold is rallying, but that the currencies in which it's denominated are falling. So gold is always a ratio. It's valued more as a currency than a commodity, and that's why it's considered a monetary metal. The price has rallied really rather impressively up to $1,500, and there is now room for some consolidation, particularly with scope for a rebound in stock markets taking hold. But the much bigger picture is that gold has broken out of its base formation, and as long as it is trading above the $1,350 area, then this is a new bull market. And because of the scope for massive monetary and fiscal stimulus to reignite animal spirits in the global economy, then there is, I think, ample scope for gold to continue to rally here. When we look at the oil price, well, it has been really rather range-bound, and despite the fact that we had a rebound in stock markets over the course of Friday, oil was not able to hold on to its gain. One thing that I think is important is shale oil has been a game changer for the energy sector. We've been talking about that now for what feels like an awfully long time, and that remains very much the case. It's putting a lid on prices as they approach $80, because a lot of additional supply becomes economic at those levels, particularly on a WTI basis. A lot of the production that occurs in the Permian is by smaller companies, and it's very fragmented. And those companies borrowed a lot of money in the hope that they were going to be able to produce at very profitable levels for a sustained basis. The quantity of oil that they're producing is keeping a lid on prices, and at $54, a significant number of them are rather pressured in terms of their business models. One of the biggest changes to the economics of the oil market is that unconventional wells are much more expensive to drill and to implement, and then you get much more prolific output as a result of that, but it peaks rather early. On the one hand, that creates elasticity in terms of supply. They don't have to drill until prices are high enough to justify the expense. But when prices stay lower for longer, it starts to put into doubt the ability of these kinds of companies to pay back the debt that they had originally taken out to drill their first wells. So there is this rolling debt structure in a number of these smaller companies that is highly dependent on prices moving higher. What we're starting to see is that I'm trying to figure out what my I can't remember my ticker, I'm afraid. I made it yesterday. The high yield energy spreads have been expanding, and this is in fact leading the high yield sector generally. It's currently at nearly 600 basis points, Well, what this is starting to show us is that some of the risk that's being priced in into the high yield sector is really focused on the energy sector. That if we're thinking about one of the potential flashpoints that is likely to cause an issue, that is likely to create some stress in the high yield sector, then it's likely to emerge first in the energy sector. There is a substantial quantity of debt that has been issued to these high yield issuers in the energy sector. It accounts for about 15% of the total high yield sector. The fact that it is now under stress is starting to put upward pressure on the broader high yield sector, and that's up to 470 basis points now. Generally, it's when the measure moves above 500 basis points that we do start to see stress coming through in the equity markets. So that does represent a challenge. It is rather important, therefore, that oil prices do not fall below $50. If they start moving significantly below $50, then that is going to turn a significant number of those smaller energy companies in the USA into loss-making enterprises, and it's going to inhibit their ability to meet their coupon payments. So that's where some of the clearest risks are emerging in the high yield sector. Then, of course, we have the kinds of companies that are totally addicted to debt. Netflix, however, was in positive territory on Friday. It does tend to rally when there is potential for additional stimulus coming through, and anything that will depress its ability to, or depress the rates at which it borrows money. Nevertheless, it has broken downwards from that overhead range. It needs to do substantially more than it has done already to push back above the trend mean. This does not look like an especially bullish pattern. In fact, it looks like a sustained breakdown with scope for a little bounce in the short term. Netflix is increasing the price it charges for mediocre programming, and it has got a significant issue with having an ongoing need for tapping the bond markets to fund its massive spending programs. And that's not a particularly good recipe for sustained profitability. Then, when we think about the fate of Uber, they reported a $5 billion loss in the last quarter, and the price initially bounced on that news. Well, subsequently, it gave up all of that bounce and more. Well, it is now bouncing in here today, but this is a company that could quite easily go bust in the next recession. They simply have an ongoing need for additional funds. Whether that is going to be from the equity markets or from the bond markets is open to question, but they have got a very narrow runway to future profitability, and they are inhibited from raising prices. For the simple reason that people could quite easily start to go back and start using taxis again. It has now become such an inconvenience to get an Uber at LAX Airport that it is more expedient these days to get a taxi home and an Uber to the airport because of the traffic considerations and the long wait that you have to have for an Uber. And these kinds of considerations are real, and the ability of the company to continue to please investors is, I think, rather open to question. Then, of course, we're going to have the lock-in in terms of the ability of insiders to sell is rapidly approaching. When we think about the similar pattern that we see in Lyft, then I think this is a very common factor to both of these companies. That is, I think, a view of some of the problem areas in terms of the high yield markets. There are also a substantial number of companies that are at risk of a downgrade and that are already trading at the lower rung of the investment grade sector, and that they will likely be downgraded during the next recession. That will enormously swell the quantity of bonds that are in the high yield market, and that will result in spreads widening even further. So, when we think about how the bond bull market will eventually end, then that is certainly one of the risk factors. But if we are now moving towards coordinated monetary and fiscal stimulus, then that might be put on the long finger. One point that I think is important is to remember that when we think about the impact of the yield curve inverting, that the yield curve inverted in early 1998 and the market went up almost 50% afterwards. The yield curve went became inverted in 2006 and the market went up another 30%. Well, the yield curve has just become inverted here, and therefore we have to be at least prepared for the potential that the market is going to go up significantly from here before we get the next recession. That markets will first price in all of the stimulus. Once all that stimulus has been priced in, and then we start to get corporate profits deteriorating, that's when you start to get real problems coming through in terms of the stock market. And it is really quite normal for the stock market to rally after the inverted yield curve. What I think is most important to bear in mind is that when it does happen, that's when we need to pay most attention to the consistency of trends. Corporate profits have basically gone nowhere since 2012, and this chart does tend to be it tends to have its data points reassessed on an ongoing quarterly basis. I re-downloaded the data for it in the chart library earlier this week because our chart had actually shown that corporate profits had broken out in the first quarter of this year, but the data has subsequently changed. Well, that's always problematic when we look at these this data coming through from governments, that the revisions do tend to skew the view, and then you get a line of best fit historically, which isn't a great help in terms of looking at it on a forward-going basis. But one thing we do know is that when corporate profits do peak, then that is generally a lead indicator for a recession. And they have not quite peaked yet. In fact, this has been an incredibly sustained period of high profitability for US corporations over the course of the last 6 years. But the fact that profits have been going sideways has contributed to margin expansion, or to valuation expansion, excuse me. And there is potential for valuations to expand even further if we are moving towards coordinated monetary and fiscal stimulus. There is the real potential that we're at the point in the cycle today where we're on the cusp of the bubble phase in equities. And that will be particularly the case if the Federal Reserve and other central banks engage in equity buying. We've seen that done by both Japan and Switzerland, and it has helped to arrest declines in their respective stock markets. In fact, the Swiss stock market has been one of the few that has been pushing to new highs over the course of the... Oops, I pressed the wrong button there. It's been one of the few that pushed onto new high ground over the course of the last few weeks. Now, there is the potential that equity buying is going to form part of the strategy that the Federal Reserve or the ECB in fact engages in. The ECB has already engaged in some corporate bond buying, and corporate bonds are already at really quite high yields, and a significant number in fact have negative yields. Well, one of the places where you still have a positive yield is in equities, and that does hold out the prospect that one of the stimulative measures that could be deployed is buying equities, and that would be a very significant bullish factor, because it would introduce into the equity market the potential for governments to start taking significant holdings in the equity market. The question subsequently would be when the government becomes a substantial holder in the equity market, will they then require seats on boards? Perhaps a question for a future date. The more important question, I think, is that when we look at the S&P 500 and do so on a longer-term basis, we can see that the 200-day moving average does tend to offer support on a sustained basis. But when we think about it in terms of if I simply look at it on a weekly basis, that we do generally tend to get support coming through in the region of the 1,000-day moving average during secular bull markets. And as long as that 1,000-day moving average continues to hold, then we're still in a secular bull market. And I do think that that is one of the most important points. If we are moving towards a period in time where governments are willing to directly support equity prices, then that is a boon for investors. That is something that could really help to stoke investor interest. And it's something that could contribute to bubbly activity. Then it's also likely to continue to support the gold price. When we think about the Dow gold ratio, and I'm trying to bring that up right now, when we look at the outperformance of equities over the course of the last 8 years, it has been really quite profound. But gold has been outperforming for most of the last few months. When we think about the outlook, therefore, and the scope for gold to outperform or equities to outperform, there have been periods during secular bull markets where gold has outperformed, and yet the secular advance has persisted. We've certainly seen that gold is taking the impetus at the present moment. There is the potential that gold could go up faster than the equity markets. That's something that hasn't really been considered very much. Or that equity markets do pause for a while and gold outperforms. One thing we can say about the ratio, however, is that it has broken its sequence of higher reaction lows. And that does suggest that there is a real potential that gold is going to continue to outperform for the next while. And that holds out the prospect that we are going to get the change in the global monetary and fiscal environment that the bond markets are pricing in, that we are going to get much more bond buying, outright control of the yield curve, potentially even equity buying, and we're also likely to see a range of additional extraordinary measures. But the most likely in the short term is coordinated efforts between governments and central banks to try and arrest the declines in their respective economies. Europe is beginning to show signs that it is willing to do that. We're unlikely to see any really big move until potentially September. And China also needs to do more. The stock market there is right in the region of the trend mean and is starting to demonstrate some support. The big state-owned banks continue to get funding from the central government and are at the lower end of their range, but it's in the regional banks where the problems are. It's also in the extraordinarily high values of property prices in places like Hong Kong or Australia or Canada, and in the coasts of the USA and in London, where some of the risks are sitting if we don't see more direct support coming through for economies and for the bond markets. But the reality is that if we do get lower interest rates and we start to see equity prices moving higher again, then that will continue to support property prices. So there is the scope here for an additional leg on the upside that we are going to move into truly bubbly phases in equities, bonds, and properties. And generally speaking, then that is also potentially what politicians want. It's not generally until you get a crisis that politicians have the cover to introduce truly revolutionary policies. So if you are of the cynical mindset, then you would engineer a crisis so that you can, in fact, introduce those revolutionary policies. One thing we know for certain is that there are massive unfunded liabilities in Europe and North America, and there is no way that those unfunded liabilities in Social Security and healthcare are ever going to be funded normally. Therefore, it's quite likely we're going to have to see massive devaluations of currencies, much more inflation, and then the potential for some of those promises to get rolled back or to get paid out in a different manner. And that can't possibly get passed without a crisis. So the chances are that we are going to have a bubble, and then we're going to have a crisis, and that is when we're going to get the answer whether the rise in populism is going to manifest itself on the left, which will result in redistribution, or whether it is going to manifest itself on the right, which will potentially at least focus on equality of opportunity. That's very much open to question. The big point, of course, is that we probably need to get the bubble first. And I do think that that is the most likely scenario. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.